This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. For the next 15 minutes or so, we want to talk about ideas for using hip-hop in education. So in a few minutes, we'll learn about the Hip-Hop Sisters Foundation and the scholarship it offers to students who are studying urban art. But first, one woman is using hip-hop to build excitement about STEM classes. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Joining us now is Danielle Lee, a postdoctoral research associate who uses hip-hop to connect the dots between culture and science for young people of color. Danielle, it's so nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It makes sense to me, of course, to connect hip-hop to culture, right? That's a no-brainer.
Right.
And it makes sense to me. I was a music major. I totally get the connection between music and math. Music is entirely based off of math. But then how do you get music to connect students to technology and engineering?
Well, I mean, first of all, you need these skills to even produce music these days and to distribute it and create new sounds. And so I know many of my friends who are more on the physical science side and the engineering side have successfully used that. One of the communities I belong to is the hip-hop ed community, and there's a weekly Twitter chat. And so we have all types of educators who come on board, and they talk about using hip-hop, you know, in understanding engineering and technology, as well as all types of lessons, including the social sciences and language arts.
Okay. Now, Danielle, I just want to be the devil's advocate here, because one of the biology teachers at my son's school tried to teach about genetics, and he was full disclosure, he was like a 55-year-old white guy, and he wrote this rap about genetics, and the kids could not have been more turned off. They thought it was the lamest thing they'd ever seen. So how do you use hip-hop, but when it comes from a professor's mouth, isn't it automatically not cool?
It depends. So this is what it's based about. It's about cultural relevancy. So simply co-opting hip-hop, or in this case creating a rap, isn't good enough. That's just putting it to rhyme. It's no different than Sesame Street or anything else. I can't spit a rhyme to save my life. I can't. That's not what I do. But I listen to enough rap music, and I dance to it, and I love it. And so I inherently get it. The only thing I do is just simply go, this song that I hear, this song that all of us can sing the words to and dance to, I hear something in it that reminds me of lessons that I've learned in my biology classes or that I teach to my students. And I just simply use those lessons as a springboard.
Okay, so give me an example of a song that you could use in a science class.
An example of a song, so a very common, since you said genetics, a very common misunderstood lesson is the difference between inheritance and heritability in genetics. So how you inherit traits, or how traits come to be in families. And so I usually give a lesson explaining the difference. Inherited means that you actually genetically pass it on. Heritable means it runs in families. Yes, it could be genetically related, but it just simply could be because of environmental factors or cultural factors. And so I like the song Get It From My Mama is a really good way to introduce it to students to help them understand.
Right.
And so by listening to the lyrics of the song, we then deconstruct it. They go, okay, how does she get it from my mama? You know, what are the rules of inheritance, inheritability, of how we inherit certain physical traits? In this case, a woman, because that's what the song is focusing on. You know, those things can be genetic as well as environment. And then understanding that, you know, what we see as a phenotype is a combination of those genetic and environmental traits. And so it reinforces vocabulary, it gets us into topics, you know, that's personally interesting and relevant to students. Baby, what you get your body from? Tell me what you get your body from. Baby, what you get your body from? Tell me what you get your body from. I got it from my mama. I got it from my mama. I got it from my mama. I got it. Honey looking good from my head to
you know, Danielle, I want to ask about a controversy that you were part of recently. You had an exchange with the life sciences blog Biology Online, and you were asked if you would be a contributor to the blog, and you asked about what the compensation was. You found out it was unpaid, and you declined. And then they asked if you were, and I want to quote here, an urban scientist or an urban whore. Do you feel like that's an individual experience, just something that was a unique experience that happened to you, or do you feel like this is part of the problem we've been having with women in STEM sciences, period?
I think I think my experience was very extreme, first of all. But, yes, it is something, sadly, that women do tend to experience, this notion that we don't have the right to negotiate for ourselves. And when we do, you know, we're called out of our name. Most people tend to use the B word whenever we're assertive and right. stick up for ourselves. But, yeah, sadly, I do think this is a problem in some of the STEM fields, particularly most of my experiences are in academia, that, you know, you get sideways looks if you're too assertive.
So then how do you translate that, since you're, part of your mission is to bring kids, especially kids and girls of color, into the STEM sciences? Do you prepare them for experiences like that?
As they get older and if the conversation comes up, I absolutely do. I will at least one-on-one have some real talk conversations with young people that you know, that have expressed an interest in really, really going full on into the sciences. It's important for them to brace themselves. Yes, I believe the culture needs to change, and I think some very important strides are being made, but it would be disingenuous of me to not prepare them for what to really expect.
So how does one, you know, all we hear about, it seems like lately in the school systems, is how difficult the task is to get kids prepared, and especially kids in urban districts such as you're focusing on, mm-hmm. the underrepresented, as you described them, who maybe are not getting great, they don't have access to labs, they're not getting the kind of the preparation for the STEM sciences that other kids in other districts may. How do you connect with them? How do you make it interesting? Is it just through the use of hip-hop music?
No, I mean, that's what I do. I don't think that's the whole answer. It's a complicated answer. We didn't get ourselves in this situation overnight, and we're not going to dig ourselves overnight. It really will take a concerted, comprehensive effort. And one of the things that I've come to realize in working with young people is that it is imperative that we involve the adults in their lives in this mission. Because at the end of the day, if you want them to really have a leg up, they need to participate in these summer academies, these authentic research programs. We need to give them permission and the time available to go after school and work in labs. And it takes the parents to either shuttle them back and forth between them programs or relieve them of household duties that many of them have responsibilities to. So we're going to need the adults in their lives to really, really, you know, take a stand and perhaps even a sacrifice that this young kid isn't going to take a summer job this summer. They're going to work in a lab. And some of these lab programs are paid. Many of them are not. But the benefits of working in a lab and working with a scientist is a complete mind blower. Think about this. If you work in a lab for even a summer, your letters of recommendation for college are going to come from college professors, not just high school teachers.
That's probably worth a summer's worth of unpaid work, I would imagine.
Yes.
Danielle Lee is a postdoctoral research associate at the Department of Zoology at Oklahoma State University and a blogger for Scientific American. She joined us from her office there. Thank you so much, Danielle.
Thank you.
Much has been made of Saturday Night Live and its newest cast, namely that the show doesn't feature any black women. Well, Saturday Night, in its opening sketch, SNL addressed the criticism head on.
Michelle, this is such a treat. I feel like it's been years since I've seen you.
And it has. The Michelle there is supposed to be Michelle Obama. But the last time the show had a female cast member who could play Obama was in 2007 with Maya Rudolph. On Saturday, Michelle Obama was played by the show's guest host, actress Kerry Washington.
It may feel that way, but I'm always here for you, and I always will be here for you.
The show put Washington through her paces, making her play another prominent black woman, Oprah, in the same sketch. Then came this.
The producers at Saturday Night Live would like to apologize to Kerry Washington for the number of black women she will be asked to play. We made these requests both because Miss Washington is an actress of considerable range and talent, and also because SNL does not currently have a black woman in the cast. As for the latter reason, we agree this is not an ideal situation and look forward to rectifying it in the near future. Unless, of course, we fall in love with another white guy first.
NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans wasn't sure what to make of the sketch.
You see the first sketch and you wonder, are they really taking the issue seriously? I mean, haha, isn't it funny? We don't have any black women in the cast.
And the joke didn't end with Kerry Washington.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night.
That's none other than Al Sharpton. TV critic Eric Deggans says the decision to end the sketch with the civil rights leader sends a clear message.
Even Al Sharpton is on board with making fun of this idea that there are no black women on SNL, which to me is a way of sort of saying maybe you people who have talked about this are taking it too seriously.
Saturday Night Live, responding to critics the only way it knows how.
Mr. President, great news. Beyonce has just arrived for dinner, too.
Beyonce!
Don't even.
For nearly a decade, Thursday nights on ABC have belonged to one woman, Shonda Rhimes. She's the writer-creator of smart, sexy dramas that get people talking and keep viewers watching. First, there was Grey's Anatomy, set in a Seattle hospital where the love lives of its interns and residents are as complicated as their work lives. Then, Private Practice, and now, Scandal. Scandal features the glamorous Washington, D.C. insider Olivia Pope. She's a crisis manager, a fixer, with wizard-like skills to make all manner of problems go away. She also used to work for the president, the dashing Republican Fitzgerald Grant, and remains connected to him in a deeply personal way. In this scene, Olivia, played by Kerry Washington, confronts a young woman who claims to have had an affair with the president.
I'll give you some free advice. Hand in your resignation, then pack up your dog and your things, get in your car and go. Find a small city, Minneapolis maybe, or Denver. Get a little job, meet a boring boy, make some friends. Because in this town, your career is over. You're done.
As dreamed up by Shonda Rhimes, the Washington, D.C. at the heart of Scandal has a Camelot-like veneer concealing some very dark deeds. When we sat down together, we spoke of murder, torture, blackmail.
It is a dark, amoral world. We're working on the idea that for America, in the world of the show, America sees Washington as this very fairy tale, beautiful place, and that everybody who works there is really helping keep that illusion alive. But they're all very much aware that with that peeled away, they're just monsters set adrift in a world in which, you know, there are no rules.
Well, Olivia Pope, the main character, she's basically working behind the scenes. And she was inspired by a real person, an expert in managing crises.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman, Judy Smith, she has a few things in common with Olivia Pope.
She does. Judy Smith is pretty amazing. And when I sat down with her the first time and met her, I really got a sense of how complex and strange her daily life must be. I mean, she's done Monica Lewinsky, she's done Michael Vick, she's done lots of politicians, and she's very, very good at what she does. But it's also a very dark job to some degree, I think. I mean, obviously, you know, she's not Olivia Pope, but she is very powerful. And a lot of the qualities that Olivia Pope has when she's solving these crises are things that I sort of gleaned and took from Judy.
She's strong. She's stylish. Very attractive.
Yes, very stylish. Very attractive.
African-American woman.
Yes.
Were you intending to make Olivia Pope African-American from the beginning?
Yes. Being an African-American woman felt to me like there were certain things about that job that would leave her as being the only black person in the room a lot of the time. And there were ways in which she would be treated that I felt were very specific to the black experience. We did an episode where she walks into a room and the client immediately assumes that Abby, who is sort of the tall, white redhead who she works with, is Olivia Pope, simply because she's the white woman in the room versus the black woman in the room. And, you know, that's the thing that's happened to me. And there were things about it that I thought were very interesting.
It's no spoiler to say, because this is actually at the heart of the show, that Olivia Pope has been having an affair with the married president of the United States.
Yes, they've been having an on-again, off-again affair for a while. And it is the biggest scandal of them all, that they spend a great deal of time trying to cover up. And Olivia spends a lot of time trying to sometimes hide even from herself.
It would seem there would be a risk in setting that as a kind of a basis for the story, because Olivia being with a married man all by itself could make her somewhat unsympathetic.
I wasn't really interested in whether or not the characters felt sympathetic in traditional ways. I feel like that is an old-fashioned notion for television at this point in time. I mean, everybody's favorite character right now is Walter White, and he was a meth-making drug king over on, you know, Breaking Bad. So I wanted her to feel watchable, and I wanted her to feel incredibly flawed in this sort of Shakespearean tragedy that also should feel a little bit realistic in terms of her pain.
I'm wondering, when it comes especially to writing single women who are complicated, like Olivia Pope, like at least two of your main characters on Grey's Anatomy, if it's changed, if you've even created the change, that is to say, they can be likable but not always likable. They're not stock characters.
It's very interesting. There's a lot of – I remember having a discussion with – an early discussion at ABC with people who no longer even work at the network before Grey's was picked up, where I was sort of brought into a room and a bunch of older guys told me that nobody was going to watch a show about a woman who had casual sex and threw a guy out the night before her first day of work, that that was completely unrealistic and that nobody wanted to know that woman. And I remember sort of sitting in that meeting and thinking, wow, they don't know anything that's going on in the world right now. And that kind of conversation, I think, would never happen now. I think now we're in a world in which nobody's worried about whether or not the women are likable. If you have a show with a female lead, which was a fairly rare thing to do a little while ago, because it was so rare, everybody wanted that person to be perfect because she had to represent everybody. Olivia Pope is very rare because she's an African-American woman, and everybody wants her to be perfect because she has to represent everybody. So there's a box that you get placed in. My goal, really, is to blow that box wide open.
Where do you think you got this love for telling stories that just pull people in and hold them?
I have no idea. I feel like I've always been a writer. I've been a writer since I was a kid. I've been a writer since I was, you know, dictating stories into a tape deck and trying to get my mom to type them up when I was really, really little.
You did that?
Oh, yeah.
Joe, but I mean, you were not an only child. I know you've had five older brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I'm the youngest of six.
Did you ever, I mean, being the little one, did you ever look around and observe what they were doing and imagine their lives?
I have alarmingly normal, madly in love, boring parents who are fantastic and interesting, but definitely not in any way dramatic. But watching my brothers and sisters, who some of them were teenagers when I was little, you know, peeking through doors and listening at doors and sort of being the little kid in the room, they seemed so amazing to me when I was a child.
Scandal is in its third season now. Grey's Anatomy is 10 years. Do you know the end?
I knew the end of Grey's Anatomy, and then we kept going. So then I finally just had to write that and move past it. Who knows at this point how long that show's going to go? It's going to go as long as I feel interested in what happens to those characters. Scandal is a different kind of show. I feel like there is a finite amount of scandal to be told. So I know what the end of Scandal will be, and I don't think I'm going to change that.
I guess we don't know how long that'll be.
I know how long I think it will be, but we'll see.
Shonda Rhimes, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time.
Shonda Rhimes, creator and writer of Scandal.
The Blockbuster movie rental chain is breathing its last gasp. A few years ago, the company closed thousands of stores, went into bankruptcy, then was bought by Dish Network. And now Dish says 300 remaining Blockbuster stores will be closed by early January. While the parent company is shutting down its stores, don't be surprised if you see the Blockbuster name if you happen to be in Alaska or Texas. There are Blockbuster franchises owned by Border Entertainment, and those stores will stay open. The president of Border Entertainment, Alan Payne, joins me from Austin to explain why. Mr. Payne, welcome to the program.
Hello. Glad to be here.
And along with stores there in Texas, you also have franchises in Alaska, from Juneau to Kenai to North Pole. They have the Blockbuster sign, I guess, and they will stay open. So are brick-and-mortar movie rental stores still a viable business model for you?
Well, it's obviously viable, or we wouldn't still be open. We're still profitable. The business is not what it was 3 or 4 years ago. It has declined, but we've managed to make it work.
Well, how have you managed to do that? Because Dish says demand has clearly moved to digital distribution, people streaming movies and renting online. How do you do it?
We've just been totally focused on what the stores could do that our competition could not do. And that involves real low prices, large inventories that are tailored to the markets that we're in. And, you know, if you think about it, if you're sitting at home right now and you don't want to buy a movie, you want to rent one, the only place you can really do that is online. And a lot of people don't know how to do that. And the ones that do, it would cost them $3 or $4. So in our stores, that movie rents for 49 cents a day.
Well, how will you keep getting movies if Blockbuster is gone?
Well, they've never supplied us movies. And we've always bought movies through wholesale distribution. And in some cases, for movies that are coming from studios that don't want to sell wholesale to us, and there are a couple, we actually go to retail stores and buy them.
You just go out and buy them and then rent them?
Yes, yes.
And that works? That's a model that works?
It sounds crazy, but most mass merchants that sell movies sell them at cost. So we can go to Walmart, for example, and we'll pay about the same price to them that we would pay through a wholesale distributor.
Well, one thing I've read, Mr. Payne, is that at least in Alaska, your business is helped because a bunch of people wouldn't have inexpensive internet access. They wouldn't have the bandwidth to be able to easily stream movies. So they need to come to you to rent them.
Yeah, you know, one of our competitors, obviously, is online streaming, and that consumes a lot of bandwidth. So most of the internet providers in Alaska, as I understand it, they charge more to heavy users.
Well, Mr. Payne, do you look forward and see an end point? I mean, do you assume that you can stay viable as a movie rental business indefinitely?
You know, the business is declining, but it's slow. And I don't have my head in the sand. I know that we're challenged by all the technology. But I haven't given up on the opportunity that it might flatten out at some point. You know, so that's what we work toward. But, you know, we have to be realistic and realize that it is declining.
You know, I wonder if managers of these stores are hearing from people who still like the notion that they can come in and maybe ask for advice about a movie or get something recommended by the person behind the counter.
We have about 40,000 people through our stores every week, through 26 stores. The stores are busy. Part of why people come, obviously, is for the community experience of seeing friends and seeing people, you know, our employees in the stores that obviously know movies. So that's part of why we're still here, because a lot of people like that experience.
Well, Mr. Payne, thanks for talking to us. Best of luck.
Thank you.
That's Alan Payne, president of Border Entertainment, which owns 26 Blockbuster franchises in Alaska and Texas that will stay open even after Blockbuster's parent company shutters hundreds more.